Welcome one, welcome all to the WOB Radio Hour. Today we're starting off with a song, The Red Flag, written by Joe Hill in 1913 from the Little Red Songbook.
The worker's flag is deepest red. It's shrouded oft our martyr dead. And ere their limbs grew stiff and cold, their lifeblood dyed its every fold. Then raised the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It waved above our infant might, when all ahead seemed dark as night. It witnessed many a deed and vow. We must not change its color now. Then raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. With heads uncovered, swear we all to bear it onward till we fall. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song shall be our parting hymn. Then raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Welcome one, welcome all again to the WOB Radio Hour. Today you're on Radio Tacoma 101.9 Low Power FM and 95.3 KTQA. You can also find us online at radiotacoma.org under the WOB Radio Hour production section. So, today we have a bit of a smaller cast because it's the holidays. Everyone's out and about getting ready for having family over, cooking a big feast, buying gifts. So today we just have myself, fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns, and I've been with the IWW since March of 2021. Fellow worker Lynn?
My name is Lynn. I go by she, her, and I've had a long history of various unions that I've been involved in through work. I'm retired now, and I really like the IWW. I think it's really the best for individual workers' rights and group of union people.
Mm-hmm. And fellow worker Gordon.
My name's Gordon. I live in Bremerton. I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch, or GMB, of the Industrial Workers of the World. I've been a Wobbly since 2008 when I retired out of the Naval Shipyard in Bremerton. My life experience has been on the left, and it was a little dicey working for the government, but they kept me aboard until I could retire. So here I am, back with the greatest union in the world.
And that's it for us today. It's just us three. We hope that you enjoy all the wonderful topics that we're going to be discussing here today regarding workers' rights, current ongoing labor struggles, and so much more. As for our outfit, we are the Industrial Workers of the World. We are a union of all trades. We're an industrial union, so no matter what you do, even if you do sex work, if you are currently incarcerated and you work in the prison system, if you are self-employed, if you're unemployed, if you're retired, we accept everybody of the working class to be a part of this organization to help organize workers in their workplace. We've been a union since 1905, since our founding in Chicago. We have a very long and storied history of standing up for workers' rights and organizing workplaces whenever workers don't earn the full value of what they deserve. And in our opinion, all labor creates all value, so workers deserve everything. So, after that, we also have a wonderful preamble, which fellow worker Lynn is going to go ahead and read a summarized version of whenever you're ready, fellow worker.
Okay. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things in life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry or in all industries, if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Lynn. That's a perfect summation of who we are and what we do. We're going to go ahead and start the program. Starting as usual with our labor report, we have quite a bit to report on. These past couple months have been pretty eventful in terms of labor organizing and workers standing up for themselves. The first thing we would like to talk about, of course, is the rail workers strike, which was expected to happen on December the 5th. But unfortunately, Congress, along with the president and many members of both the Democratic and Republican parties, have essentially forced the unions to come to the table to accept a tentative agreement that does not include paid sick time, amongst many other concerns that the rail workers and the rail workers' unions have had in this country, such as a reduction in staffing on trains. Those are pretty much the two major complaints, is a lack of sick days and a reduction of staff, which potentially makes rail work even more dangerous than it already is. It was quite scandalous in the sense that this was also pushed by our currently Democratic President Joe Biden, as well as several members who have been nominated by the DSA, such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So it was a very, very disappointing situation to see these rail workers essentially accept an agreement that they didn't want to take. As a matter of fact, as a reaction of which, rail workers with the BLET actually voted out their union president as a result of him accepting the labor deal. This is coming out of a more perfect union. And I quote, "In a stunning upset, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, the 28,000-member Union of Railroad Workers, has elected a new president, Eddie Hall, a local officer out of Division 28 in Tucson, Arizona, won against incumbent Dennis Pierce with 53% of the membership wide vote. Hall will take office on January 1st, pending official certification of the results, and will lead the larger of the two unions that make up the Teamsters Rail Conference. The surprise victory is the latest fallout from a national freight rail shutdown in which some 60,000 rail workers had a contract imposed on them, and as I remind you, that was because of Congress. In the BLET, the second largest union involved in negotiations, members ratified a deal, but many members were unhappy with the outcome." Going on, the BLET was one of three unions that came within hours of striking in September before reaching a last-minute tentative agreement, with heavy involvement from the Biden White House and Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh. So in June, the BLET took a strike vote, its first such national vote in over a decade. Members returning ballots voted 99.5% in favor of striking.
That's a lot.
So in this one large rail union, and that's the end of my quote from that article from More Perfect Union, as the article suggests, there were a lot of workers who really wanted this strike to happen. There hasn't been a railroad strike in this country since the 90s, and that was incredibly short-lived because a rail strike in this country would have been very disruptive to the economy, which is the point of strikes. It's meant to be disruptive. It's meant to be an organized body of workers withdrawing their labor power and production in order to get more out of their employer that their employer can provide. As I've mentioned previously, that was paid sick days, which rail workers don't have, and also better staffing and safety considerations for rail workers. So it is very disappointing to see the potential of such a large labor action in this country being shut down, even by so-called progressives and quote-unquote friends of labor who are elected to office in this country. And I think this is going to stand for a very long time as an example of the economy taking precedence over the well-being of the workers in the eyes of politicians. As long as that little imaginary line keeps going up, the workers are just going to have to put up with whatever they're given, whether that's by their employers or, in this case, by Congress. Does anyone have anything they would like to add to that?
Sure. You brought up one of the labor unions involved was the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineer Trainmen.
The Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, yes.
Okay. And that's just one of many unions, I think about a dozen or maybe 13, mm-hmm. who have to negotiate individual contracts with the various railroad owners and their stockholders. So that's 13 unions that may or may not disagree. And that brings us to a very key point about the industrial workers of the world and how fellow worker Lynn described it, is that we organize industrially. That means if you work for the railroad, it doesn't matter if you sweep the station out or if you drive the train or if you load the train. You're part of the same union. That's an industrial union. That means all the trades are included. And the power of that was well recognized in 1947 when the Labor Management Relations Act, better known as Taft-Hartley, got rammed through Congress under an unpopular president, who was Truman at the time, I believe, and basically sideswiped the whole National Labor Relations Act, or the Wagner Act, that was passed in 1935, that gave workers the right to organize. And so it's a key point to me. Every time I hear about, well, how come all these other guys didn't go out, right?
Why wasn't there a general strike even? Yeah.
Exactly. And that's my take on it, is that we're hobbled by reactionary labor law, and even when our best instincts kick in. For instance, the IWW does a lot of solidarity work, meaning, you know, we hear about and we show up on their picket lines with their signage or with signage that indicates we support them, we're in solidarity. Because labor law even prevents us from bringing our own signs. And we're the IWW and we're out here in support. No, that's been covered. That's a solidarity action. The specific language in the law, federal labor law, that prohibits us from doing that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, other unions cannot, you know, go out on so-called secondary strikes, which is if one union goes on strike, we agree with the reasons why we're striking, therefore we're going to strike. That is illegal in this country, and that has very real consequences in terms of potential jail time and imprisonment for workers on the picket line. It has potential serious fines being imposed on unions for encouraging or even promoting or approving those types of actions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, labor law has, like you said, has really hobbled our ability to actually have working class solidarity in this country, and it's a great incentive to people who want to stand up for other workers in this country.
Not us, though.
Not us. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
Well, so this just proves the point that all of those 13 unions should be IWW members.
Absolutely. I mean, we are a union that encourages what's known as dual carding, which means if you're already a part of a trade union, we will accept you as a member as well. We don't see that as being a conflict of interest because we want our values and we want our mission to spread however necessary, even if you're already in a trade union. That's a very good point that you made.
Well, also a point that just really think to me is super important is the quality of family life of these workers. They do not have a set schedule. They're on call all the time. Even if they've only had you know, like 4 hours between shifts, they can be called back. And you can imagine the consequences if they don't go in. Maybe they're too tired, maybe they're sick. You can even be penalized under some of those unions for not going to work because you're sick.
Right.
You know, they can fine you, I guess. They can
demote you. You just won't have paid time off. You will lose money and therefore lose your livelihood if you fall sick or just can't make it to work.
Well, it's because we're essential workers there.
Yes.
Right?
We're essential until, like I said, the invisible black line gets threatened. But yeah.
But this is the same struggle that a lot of restaurant workers and bar workers and many different professions have, in that they don't have a schedule that will work for childcare, mm-hmm. will work for just any person that has a different schedule who needs to sleep regularly. This is really difficult for workers. I was in a union. I worked for a prison in Washington State for a while, years ago, and I didn't have a set schedule. And so sometimes I'd go home after working an 8-hour shift. I'd have to be back within 8 hours. You know, that includes transportation, that includes meals, sleeping, maybe time to be with your family. And it was just very hard. And I was young then. I can imagine, you know, the workers of all different ages having to struggle with no schedule that they can count on. So to me, that's a really big issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can't those mothers drop their kids off at a state-sponsored daycare that would be, you know, paid for with our taxes and have professionals there? Come on, you got to be kidding me, fellow worker. Are you telling me that we have to, you know, like, get daycare and education for our kids on our own?
Yeah, imagine that.
Imagine that, yeah. So, yeah, the situation with the rail workers, like I've said before, is very symptomatic of this desperate situation that labor is currently in, where we have less solidarity and less organized power than we did before. Mm-hmm. You know, labor law definitely hampers that. On the other hand, it comes at a great personal cost to the workers, like you said, who can't be with their families, who can't be properly rested, who can't rest when they're ill, who don't have any kind of, you know, significant childcare benefits or benefits for their family even sometimes. You know, it is especially disappointing that Congress even had that kind of power over workers in the first place.
And that some of our supposed champions, although I understand that there are tactics and there are, well, there's politics involved in any vote in Congress. I do understand that. And so I can fathom a little bit that some of our most progressive lawmakers voted with the administration because it was, well, if they didn't, they'd be shunned by the Democratic Party and they wouldn't get any funding to run again. And we have some effective voices in that caucus. You know me, I don't believe in the efficacy of legislation or the courts, especially these days, to uphold things that help the working class. But I think you know what I'm getting at.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely share that same frustration because there were, very progressive members of Congress, people who would have been considered the quote-unquote fringe of the Democratic Party, who are very progressive, who have very much marketed themselves as being pro-labor, pro-union, so on and so forth, who ultimately voted in favor of this compromise with the rail workers, specifically their bosses and employers, in order to keep them running over the holidays and for the foreseeable future. And I think that there definitely needs to be some accountability. I don't want to exactly point fingers towards any organization. There are plenty of left-leaning people who are angry about this. Some of those progressive members were nominated and supported by the Democratic Socialists of America. And I think the DSA is doing the right thing, or at least I hope to be the right thing, in that they have signed an open letter basically saying, we do not support what our endorsed candidates have done in regards to this forced compromise with the rail workers. We don't see this as good. We might even consider rescinding our nominations going forward in future elections, which I think is the right thing. I think that they're doing what they can to hold those elected members of Congress accountable because, like I said, you know, everybody's progressive basically until the economy is on the line. And then it becomes a very, you know, different, sometimes reactionary decision-making that comes from Congress. So I think the DSA is doing everything that they can. I mean, not just to do damage control, but to actually try and right the situation to make sure that this doesn't happen again. But still, very disappointing to see that even so-called progressive members of Congress supported this deal. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
Another issue that is just critically important in this issue between the workers and the owners of the railroads is safety. That was alluded to. But my understanding, and I haven't researched this, is that there's only two workers on a train engine.
Mm-hmm.
And the owners want to cut it down to one.
Yep.
What if that one worker has a heart attack or a stroke? Or all of a sudden they have ADHD and they lose their focus.
Or if there's the train tips. No one's there to help them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, or some wild person comes in and breaks in. There's nobody to back them up or to really get help. And so to me, would you want to be on a train with only one person managing all aspects of driving the train and stopping it? And I just think that sounds ridiculous.
It also puts a lot more liability on the worker that's running that train as well if there is an accident.
You know who would get the blame.
Exactly. The one guy at the head of the train and nobody else. Mm-hmm. It would be even easier for employers to crack down on their employees saying, you caused this accident because you were the only person in charge of this train, and therefore you are going to be fired and lose your livelihood.
Well, they had to compensate their executives. They had to compensate their CEO and their CFO and their COO at competitive rates. So something's got to be cut. So that's the salary of the workers, or the wage, and that's also the amount of crew. And they don't care. As a fellow worker, Marilyn, who is not with us today, she's in Norway. Oh, no, she's in Iceland. Mm-hmm. So shout out to fellow worker Marilyn for attending the Peace Prize ceremonies. But she was really bothered by that train wreck up in Canada. We mentioned it last broadcast, I believe, but that was the Lac-Mégantic train wreck, essentially, that had all those cars filled with crude oil. And guess what happened when the train crashed? It burst into flames, set fire to the whole city. Many, many people were killed and injured. And so the gig is that these people will push everything to the limit so that they can have a second or third vacation home, so that they can own a brand new, Mercedes-Benz limousine.
Well, and they don't take the train either.
Hell no.
They take private jets. The employers take private jets.
That's right.
Yeah. No. It hopefully, there has been some encouragement for a wildcat strike amongst many of us who have been following the situation, and that is one of our later roundtable discussion topics. We will get back to that. But as for this current situation, we are eagerly looking forward to what might happen with rail workers. Hopefully they will find the ability to strike again at some point in the future. Hopefully members of Congress will be held accountable, although I have my doubts about that. I know the DSA is doing everything that it can, but we will obviously provide more updates as this develops, because this is a huge moment in labor history, especially for the rail workers. We have other labor reports to get to as well. The New York Times recently had a one-day strike with its workers, who I believe, and I have an article for this, the workers were basically concerned about potential layoffs happening. There's been a bunch of larger media companies, such as the New York Times, Facebook, Twitter, so on and so forth, who have been going through these layoffs. They did a one-day strike in order to protect themselves against that. Another story that we also have is Warrior Met Coal, which has been striking down in Alabama, I believe, has been on strike for 600 days and counting for better working conditions and wages. And then the last one I want to touch on is actually ongoing right now. There was a previous action, which was a one-day strike, the Starbucks Red Cup strike, when all the unionized stores walked out for a day at the start of the holiday sale for REI, where they basically, they break out the iconic red cups for the holiday season. They did a one-day strike to basically tell their employers and their CEO to get to the negotiating table and start negotiating union contracts with their unionized stores, which they actually have a significant number of now.
Yeah, nowadays they do.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, A year ago, from December 9th, was the first, was the founding of the first organized Starbucks store, and now they have up to 270 stores and 7,000 union workers. So this has been a rapidly building union movement in Starbucks. Currently happening right now is actually a three-day strike. So they've expanded it from 1 to 3 days. Today is the second day as of the day of this recording, and today is the 17th of December. Taking a quote here from the Starbucks Workers United Facebook page, "It is day two of the Double Down strike, the biggest strike in Starbucks history, and workers are standing strong. Union workers are fighting for everything from full staffing to consistent schedules. We're protesting Starbucks' blatant retaliation, such as the closure of union stores and firing of union leaders." So they are basically asking for better schedules, more consistent staffing, better security measures, better wages in certain areas. And of course, they're demanding that the Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz, come to the negotiating table with these unionized workers and actually start having contracts. He has famously said previously that he would not negotiate with unionized stores or with the union, which would also be blatantly in violation of current labor law, because once a place has successfully voted to unionize through the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, you as the employer have to come to the negotiating table by a certain point and negotiate a contract. And Starbucks has specifically and intentionally not done that in order to do everything that they can to break this union. So please stand up for your fellow workers at Starbucks. Please respect the picket lines wherever strikes are going on across the country. Like we said, there's 270, soon to be more, stores and several thousand workers that are depending on your solidarity. Don't buy gift cards for Starbucks over the holiday season if you haven't already. You know, show up to the picket line if you can. Look up where the picket lines are in your state or your city and support them however you can, because these people really do better. They deserve better for their labor.
You could even bring coffee for these striking workers.
Yeah, absolutely.
What brand?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Homebrew.
Yeah. So a very brief note on the Starbucks gift card situation. This year you can help organizing baristas by not buying Starbucks gift cards this holiday season. We love treating those who appreciate with gift cards, but Starbucks does not respect workers' rights. We're asking that you choose an alternative gift this year. No contract, no gift cards. And that's again from Starbucks Workers United on their Facebook page.
Excellent quote. Excellent slogan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think fellow worker Lynn touched on this previously, that, you know, a lot of people who work in the service industry are very overworked. They often have to deal with inconsistent schedules. They often have to deal with sometimes hostile customers. Depending on where you live, the wages might be enough. They might not be enough. Starbucks has also threatened retaliation by threatening to pull healthcare, specifically trans healthcare, from workers at unionized stores who are trans. So they are doing everything that they can to bust this union, up to and possibly including illegal action. Mm-hmm. Several workers have been fired for being union organizers or for being even alleged union organizers.
That's an unfair labor practice under U.S. law.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those workers have gone to court and have successfully gotten the right to be rehired back to them. Starbucks has been found guilty, I believe, on a couple different situations. Yeah. We actually talked about this in a previous episode. Do you remember the Starbucks union furry? The guy that showed up to the union rally in, like, his fursuit and stuff, and he was like, "I was fired for being threatening, intimidating," because he was a union organizer, and he showed up in his fursuit to this rally up in Seattle, and he's like, does this cartoon husky look threatening to you? And he got a huge amount of support over social media. He kind of became, in some circles, like, the unofficial mascot of the Starbucks Workers Union. He recently posted on his Twitter that him and several of his coworkers who were fired for organizing at their location got their jobs back. So
that's good.
Shout out to Apollo Husky for getting his job back. But yeah.
Shout out to Worker Solidarity,
too.
There
we go.
And you mentioned a really good slogan. There's another really good slogan. The labor movement. The folks who brought you the weekend and the maximum 8-hour workday.
You read that sticker on my laptop, didn't you?
But a lot of people don't know that that's how we got the 8-hour workday. And weekends off didn't used to exist.
Right. We used to have a greater demand for consistent schedules, such as the 8-hour day.
Yep.
You know, 8 hours to work, 8 hours to rest, 8 hours to what we will. And of course, we'll talk in the future about the 8-hour workday and whether or not that's still applicable to the current work environment. But yeah, no, you're right. We used to have a greater demand and a greater solidarity for having consistent work schedules,
mm-hmm.
work schedules that work for us. And unfortunately, both in non-organized labor and in organized labor, there has been kind of this, I don't want to use the term slippery slope because that's a logical fallacy, but there has been this recession of having constant and consistent work schedules that work for workers. In the case of Starbucks, it's often, you know, week by week or every 2 weeks, they'll give you a schedule and say, here are the days that you're working.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you have a doctor's appointment. Maybe you need to spend time with family. Maybe you're going on vacation. You have to make those work days. There's very little wiggle room to get out of your schedule. So especially in the case of the Starbucks workers, this has been a long time complaint, and this actually goes back to when the IWW tried to organize Starbucks way back in the early aughts, the early 2000s. That was one of the major complaints there as well, was that essentially it was kind of a gamble as to what your schedule was.
Yep.
They would just put you wherever you needed to inconsistently. And so, you know, the Starbucks Workers United has done a fantastic job in organizing on that particular point.
Just to amplify on that point, for the past 30 years or so, owners of big profitable companies have been reclassifying their employees so that they're not quite employees, because to be an employee means you're covered by labor law. They'll say you're an independent contractor,
mm-hmm.
or you got to talk to the franchisee, right? A lot of these stores are not corporate owned. Some of them are, I'm given to understand, but a lot of them are franchises. And so they'll say, well, you gotta argue with your employer, not us, not the corporation. We have nothing to do with it. They're a franchise, mm-hmm. right? So, and that counts for the import truckers, too. They can't even join the Teamsters Union. Not that the Teamsters Union always welcomes new people into its ranks, but we'll touch on that some other day. But the whole point about that thing is that if you're reclassified as a independent contractor, you're not covered by labor law. The maintenance of that truck or the cleaning up of that store and the maintenance of the coffee making equipment, that's on you. You're an independent contractor. We don't have to cover that. So it's very, very important, because many Americans think that if you work for somebody, you're covered.
I would also like to go off on that point, in that a lot of times, as a matter of fact, I think under current U.S. labor law, independent contractors do not have a right to organize. In this case, with the Starbucks Workers United, Starbucks workers do have a right to organize because they are direct employees of the corporation, or at mm-hmm. least of the franchise. So they are allowed to organize. But in this case that you're describing, independent contractors, employees who are not hired directly by an employer, but rather a subcontractor,
yep.
or like you said, a franchise in some situations, they do not have the right to organize in this country. And that is a huge loophole in labor law that is yet to get resolved. But as for the Starbucks workers, today is the second day of their 3-day strike. They're asking people not to buy gift cards, to respect the picket line, and to learn why they're organizing so that you can provide solidarity, whether it's on the picket line or it's in your purchasing decision. You know, obviously we here in the IWW, who have had previous history with trying to organize Starbucks, have all of our love and solidarity for these workers, and we wish them all the best and offer them all the support that we can going forward. That pretty much wraps up our labor report. Fellow worker Gordon.
Just to amplify again on that last point, our fellow workers of the Watkins Gadget IWW, focused around Bellingham and Mount Vernon, have actually been asked by the Starbucks Workers Union to come out and support. And they've even given targeted stores that they know that the workers need to be unionized. And when you got a bunch of noisy wobblies showing up in front of your door, mm. right? It's a big pain in the neck, if you get my meaning. And so IWW, that's an example of, hey, no hard feelings. We tried organizing you. Now you're organized. We're going to come and support you anyway, because we love the working class, and that's what we do.
Absolutely. Fellow worker Lynn, did you have anything to add?
I was thinking that rather than if people like to give gift cards, and many of us do, maybe you could research stores or corporations that are unionized. Like Kroger around here is, Safeway is, and you can get a whole lot of variety of things at a Fred Meyer or a Kroger store that isn't just groceries. So, I mean, investigate some of those organizations and get something that supports the workers.
Don't go to Starbucks anyway. It's kind of sucky coffee.
Go to your
local coffee shop, locally owned and probably way more progressive.
At least during the time of the strike. Other than that, we only buy Starbucks from union stores.
And there's not very many independent ones either.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, Starbucks does definitely have a monopoly on it, but in this case, you know, the workers are finally standing up for their rights. So the moral of the story is buy union coffee. If you're buying coffee from Starbucks, go to the union store and support them.
That's right.
That pretty much brings us to the conclusion of our labor report. We will be providing more updates on these stories and others in upcoming episodes in the following months. Thank you. Moving forward into our show today, we'd like to open this up to a roundtable discussion with the other two fellow workers here. We want to go over the historical and possibly present topic of wildcat strikes and industrial sabotage. As we talked about earlier with the rail workers, briefly, there was large support from the pro-labor union left-wing circles to encourage them to wildcat strike. The technical definition of that is essentially workers organizing and going on strike without the permission of union leaders or obviously their employers or any other body. Essentially, the workers decide to go on strikes autonomously on their own. There's been a long history of wildcat strikes. Some of you might remember from the early 80s and the beginning of the Reagan era, there were the air traffic controllers who went on strike. That was a wildcat strike. The IWW has been a long-term supporter of wildcat strikes, and current labor law essentially declares them to be illegal. So we don't officially support illegal actions as a union, but we do have a long history of supporting that in the past before it became illegal. Wildcat strikes are often, they have an effect in the sense that workers themselves are directly building their solidarity and directly building their collective power to do this, even if their union leaders tell them not to strike or are still waiting to decide whether or not to go on strike. In regards to the current plight of the rail workers in this country, like I said, there has been a lot of talk and discussion about them going on a wildcat strike and striking for themselves, despite what Congress and their union leaders have forced them to accept in regards to this recent labor compromise with the rail workers unions. So I'd like to open that up to a discussion. As for the history of wildcats, just to touch on this briefly, there was also a previous general strike, and it was a wildcat strike, of rail workers back in 1877. That was a very prominent moment in labor history in the United States because this was hundreds of thousands of people walking off the job. Mm-hmm. Not just the rail workers themselves, but other industries as well that depended on the rail workers in order to function, which is a pretty large part of the economy, as you can imagine. And in 1877, rail was the way to get around.
That's it.
So
it was the internet of the era.
Yes, it was.
And they didn't have the social media to advertise these things.
Right.
So it's more amazing still.
It spread by word. It spread by mail, possibly literally by horseback, although I think telegraph was obviously a thing by then. You know, it was a big mass movement in this country to support the rail workers who, just like now, were working for poor wages, long hours, and dangerous conditions. So that's kind of the background in terms of rail workers and wildcat strikes. But I'd like to open this up again to a roundtable discussion of, do wildcat strikes still have a place? And in regards to labor law, can we even still pull this off? Because like I said, on one hand, they can be very effective. Mm-hmm. It's the workers standing up directly for themselves as a collective body. On the other hand, as we've said previously in our labor report, there are illegal actions that unions or unionized workers can take, and that has very real consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we to do? How can we still win?
Well, in a practical sense, a wildcat strike can happen anywhere in any industry and with any number of employees at a certain, you know, business. Generally speaking, yes, they are illegal, and they can bring you to even a federal court if they feel the industry is important, like railroads and shipyards and longshore and things like that. Anyway, they can still work. You have to inoculate these workers. That's part of your AEIOU segment, fellow worker Noah. Mm-hmm. The I is inoculate. That means you got to be straight up with the employees that you're organizing with, or that you're an outside organizer coming in. You got to tell them, hey, look, this is not legal. We could all be fired. But we think, you know, it's a gamble. We think that we won't. Because if you get all 30 employees of a Starbucks store in Lower Manhattan or in Chicago or someplace like that, and they all decide to go out, that's a lot of leverage. Mm-hmm. And the company will be reluctant to fire you because of public relations.
I would also like to, excuse me, I'd also like to add to that as well, that wildcat strikes have the potential labor power in the sense that it would force companies and employers to directly negotiate with the workers, because this isn't the union endorsing,
exactly,
or advocating or telling their workers to go on strike.
Right.
It's the workers themselves directly organizing and saying, we're going to do this regardless.
And depending on your union, depending on your location, okay, because it varies. It's not a monolith. You can have very, very progressive locals, and you can have very conservative locals. So you got to judge that. You got to test the water temperature and see, you know, it's great to have all, you know, all your fellow workers organized and ready to go out no matter the consequences. But in reality, you could all get fired. It's illegal. So you got to test the water. You got to see if you've got that backup and then make your decision to go out. But they're still effective.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely a heavy pendulum, so to speak.
Mm.
I think that the IWW and all other labor unions in this country do not endorse or support illegal actions on the part of their workers.
That's right.
But these actions still have a potential to happen anyway. And if they happen, I think that as individuals outside of the organization, not acting on behalf of the organization,
mm-hmm,
we should stand in solidarity with those people when they decide to wildcat strike. We should show up to the picket strike. I'm sorry, we should show up to the picket line. We should donate to whatever pool of money they have to support the
workers. Strike fund, food, clothing for the kids, that kind of mutual aid.
Because the blunt truth of it is solidarity extends even beyond the law.
Oh, yeah.
The law does not dictate the morality of a situation.
Exactly.
In all cases. And in this case, I think that if there is a wildcat strike, whether that's of the rail workers, whether that would be of the Starbucks workers union, if that ever happened, whether that was even like a small local grocery store or just any shop in general, when the workers go out on strike, you respect the picket line and you should support them as a working class person in whatever way you can. I think that labor law has very strict limitations and regulations over workers. It was obviously created over several generations in order to limit the power of unions and to limit the power of worker organizing. And so to directly act against it in the form of a wildcat strike would be a way to force its change. Of course, we've also discussed previously general strikes, which is when a number of industries or all industries of a certain area go out on strike.
Mm-hmm.
That, in the gross majority of cases, takes place in the form of a wildcat strike. And those have been very, very
right,
effective, such as the Seattle general strike in 1919, several general strikes that have occurred on local levels. The IWW has had a couple famous ones in the Grays Harbor area here in Washington State back in the early 1900s and early 1910s in the lumber industry. This has potential effective power. Again, we cannot legally endorse it, but if it does happen on the part of individual or collective workers' action, we should still support it because it might be the only avenue by which labor law can even change in this country.
And they're taking a big chance going out. They are. They know they are. And to push a worker, let's say a single mom to push that mother to the point where she has a choice. She can grin and bear it, or she can finally stand her ground and say, no, me and my fellow employees are not going to take this crap anymore. So,
yeah, and just to be clear, that's not the union pushing
yes.
the single mother to do that. That is the working conditions pushing the single mother to do that. That is poor wages to push a single mother to do that. That is dangerous conditions. That right. is sexism or harassment in the workplace
yep.
if she's a single mother. Then, yeah, absolutely. Workers can get pushed to a point where labor law is not the first thing. I mean, there have been, you know, countless civil rights struggles, yes. labor struggles in this country where those actions were illegal. That caused legal ramifications to happen to people who mm-hmm. are organizing for a better world to live in. That is going to happen regardless. Even people who are on legal strikes, endorsed by their unions, through the proper legal channels, those people still get arrested. Mm-hmm. Those people still get thrown into jail. Those people still face fines and potential jail time for doing it to the letter of the law. So if it happens in an illegal way, the ramifications might be more severe, but they're still going to be the same.
Exactly.
So you're right. We do need to focus more on inoculating workers to the idea that, legal or not, if you go on strike, there are consequences in the terms of lost wages or potentially a worse standing with your employer or illegal firings.
Yep.
But we should still find a way, as individuals, not acting collectively on the part of our union, to support that however we
can. Sure thing. But guess what? When the IWW shows up, this has been my experience. As a single wobbly out in Kitsap County, when I was the only wob in town, that situation's changed, thank goodness. But I would show up. There was a big strike at the local hospital. And that was a bunch of, not ask me, I forget. I think they were covered by...
SEIU, potentially?
SEIU was one of the unions, and I think... United Food and Commercial Workers was another one.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, unions these days can cover workers not necessarily in that industry. So I showed up because I heard about it. I heard about it and I read about it in the newspaper. So I showed up with my wobbly T-shirt and a sign. You say unfair, mm-hmm. which is, I didn't even know the issue.
That's the limit of probably what you can say on the picket line because of labor.
Probably, yes. I can't bring my own sign. I can wear all the T-shirts I want. I can wear the buttons I want. So the thing is, I showed up and I was very surprised that a lot of the workers, most of whom in this case were college educated, they were professionals, they were like nurses' assistants, you know. When I showed up, I was really shocked. They said, IWW, yeah, now we got a real picket line going,
mm-hmm.
you know? And the funny thing is that my eye doctor showed up. He was going to his car or something. And he looked right at me, and I looked right at him, and he saw my T-shirt, and he just kind of shook his head. Very successful eye doctor, but he was sort of left-handedly giving me a shout-out. So, okay, you know, I knew you were...
I can't do this openly because I don't want to get fired.
But I knew you were crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, the IWW has also had, like you said, a fantastic history of showing up to other people's strikes or
yes.
other people's picket lines or other people's worker struggles and provided whatever solidarity, whether that's just showing up on the picket line...
That's
or
right.
...making donations to local unions who are out on strike or mm-hmm. even... through our own publications, such as this radio show, giving them a voice.
Yep.
And so I think regardless of how that happens, we should do whatever we can in order to support that. A really sad situation in this country that such actions are illegal and that many people who take part in them face significant legal consequences. And one more time for legal reasons, because I don't want to get in trouble.
I'm turning you in.
Yeah. The IWW does not endorse officially... illegal actions on any part of a worker or a collection of workers. That stands the same for any other union, trade union in this country. We cannot endorse illegal actions. But when illegal actions take place because the workers are driven to that point by their employers and by the material conditions under which they live, we still have a capacity to support them however we can. In the case of the rail workers, going back to that, I imagine that would look like not just the workers at those unions going on strike who work in the railroad industry. That could be, like you said, all the peripheral industries as mm-hmm. well. It can be the people who offload the rail. It can be people who exactly. simply are responsible for cleaning up train stations or for, you know, whatever staff or industries that immediately surround the rail industry. They could probably do an illegal secondary wildcat strike if that were to happen.
Or other tactics like a sit-in, a slowdown. You know, they can make their message clear while still being within the letter of the law.
Yeah, and even if it falls outside of the letter of the law, we need to have greater working class consciousness and working class solidarity in order for those strikes to be effective. Because there are historical cases of wildcat strikes being effective. Even if people are punished or thrown in jail, mm-hmm. the gross majority of workers still benefit from those actions. So as for the rail workers, while there has been a lot of talk about a wildcat strike or potentially even a general strike to support them, we've heard many calls on social media for a general strike over the past few years, to the point where we're probably just a little bit old of it. We're a little bit tired of hearing it, nothing materializing.
Mm-hmm.
I think in this situation, it's a big enough industry and a critical and essential enough industry to the economy to where if that did happen, if there was a wildcat strike, I think a lot of people could come out and support them in whatever way possible, whether it's just supporting the workers striking in that industry or in the peripheral industries. This has a great potential for the advancement of a better world for workers, not just in that industry. And that's the importance of wildcat strikes, is that it is workers directly taking action, regardless of official support or condemnation from their unions, to better their working lives and their lives in general. And we should support that, even if we can't officially. So that's pretty much all I have to say on that subject. I know that there are many fellow Wobblies and many fellow trade unionists who would feel the same. As for the rail situation, we're just going to have to wait and see, because it's been a while since this rail strike has been shut down. The chance right. of a wildcat strike taking logarithmically decreases as time goes on from settlements like this, especially in settlements where it's being enforced by Congress of all groups.
Yeah.
So we will just have to continue supporting the workers however we can. But if a wildcat strike happens, please show up to the picket line. They need us and we need them in order for our lives to be as comfortable and successful as we are. So I think that's all we have to say on that. Absolutely, fellow worker.
Hi, this is Pixie with Pixie's Potions. You're listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 LPFM KTAH.
Moving on to another subject. Today, on this recording, I will be covering the AEIOU acronym again for the last time. Or potentially not the last time. Maybe we'll go over it again in future episodes. We're essentially going to be mentioning this acronym of AEIOU, the basic vowels, because we in labor unions and labor organizing use it as a guideline, or at least a idea for how workers can organize their industries. So AEIOU stands for Agitate, Educate, Inoculate, Organize, Unionize. I've gone over the past four letters in previous episodes, A, E, I, and O, and today we're going to finally talk about this final step, which is unionizing. By the time you've reached this point in an organizing campaign in your workplace, you have already been agitating your fellow coworkers to think about the ways in which their work doesn't provide them what they need to live comfortably. You have educated them on what unions are and what collective action is and how they can better their standing in the workplace with their fellow workers so that they can organize. We've talked about inoculating workers, which is talking to them about the potential ramifications and consequences of whether it's taking direct action on the job, going on strike, even just having casual conversations with your coworkers about the things that make work suck. We've talked about organizing tactics and strategies such as one-on-one conversations with your coworkers, starting an organizing,
a map,
you know, yeah, right. Forming a map of your coworkers,
that's right.
A social map to see who's in support, who's not, how we can better reach people. We've talked about forming essentially an organizing committee, a driving committee, as it used to be called, to try and organize your actions within the workplace. And now today we're talking about the last letter, which is U for unionizing. So by this point, you've already done a bunch of that and are continuing to do all of that. When it comes to the you letter, we're talking about the final stages. So this is where you've built up a collective amount of solidarity and support in the workplace. You usually have anywhere from 70 to 80% of the workers on the side of unionizing, whether that's directly taking place in organizing actions or tentatively saying, if there was a union vote, I would be in support of it, even though I'm not actively helping organize the workplace. That's also another important aspect as well. When it comes to unionizing, this is the point where you can file with the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, to have a union election. This is when you notify your employer that you want to have a union election. And also, this is the point in which probably crackdowns against the union will get the strongest. Once you've gone public, once you've told your employer, we the workers want a union in the workplace, we want to take it to a vote, that's usually when employers start to begin the retaliations the most. They will start targeting workers who they suspect are involved in organizing and start finding ways to legally fire them. As we've mentioned previously with the Starbucks Workers Union, plenty of people have been fired for quote-unquote being intimidating or threatening on the job,
yeah,
which is code for talking to their coworkers about their wages and conditions, confronting their employers in direct actions such as a march on the boss, or for taking one-day strikes against their employer. They will find legal reasons to fire you. If this happens to you as a worker, there are legal recourses that you can take in order to counter that. They are time-consuming. It might take time for you to get your job back. Some people have been laid off for weeks, sometimes months. In a couple rare cases, they have been laid off for years because their employers have illegally fired them using legal methods, quote-unquote, in order to disincentivize or stop organizing in their workplace. You can file a petition with the NLRB to basically say, I have been unlawfully fired. My employer has illegally acted against me. Here's my case. They would take it to some kind of court. I can't remember it off the name of my head. And basically determine whether or not you're illegally fired. Going back to the unionization part, filing for an election with the NLRB, this is a process that you can usually take a couple months. The NLRB has to usually take in union cards if you sign union cards in the workplace to see how much support that you have, and then make a determination of when and where the election can take place. Usually after a few months, the NLRB finally says, okay, we have everything in place for you to have an election in the workplace. You file individual anonymous ballots, usually as workers or low-level management that don't have higher firepower. You have a vote in the workplace. It can take a few weeks for that to be ratified. And then if you have critical support and have been doing everything that you can in order to organize your workplace, like we said previously, one-on-one conversations, having a driving committee, reaching out to workers about their concerns in the workplace, providing mutual aid and support to them. If you have a critical enough amount of support in the workplace, no matter how big your shop, you can win these elections, get your union officially certified by the NLRB. And then from that point, you would eventually begin having contract negotiations with your employer, which is where you and whatever representatives that your union have elected to negotiate with their coworkers sit down with your employers and begin drawing up a union contract. Now, in the IWW, we are fine with the idea of union elections through the NLRB. However, one of our core founding philosophies is that we should also look towards solidarity unionism.
Yep.
The NLRB is not a perfect institution. Employers have their way of manipulating union elections to, in a few certain cases, basically gerrymander the workplace so that workers are broken up into smaller voting blocks, and therefore people that vote no against the union could potentially have more power. That does happen. Also, like I said, during the process of an election being set up, employers and sometimes even the NLRB can determine that some workers cannot vote in union elections, whether or not they're full-time workers or part-time workers, or whether or not they're quote-unquote independent contractors, like Gordon has mentioned previously. These elections are not perfect. The IWW looks at solidarity unionism in the form of directly organizing as a worker with your coworkers, taking direct action against your employer once you have a critical mass of support in the workplace, and then from there, directly negotiating with your employer in order to have them voluntarily ratify the union in the workplace or to essentially force them to endorse the union in the workplace. Apologies to the listeners. The cat has decided to leave. We have a Sabotabby here in the office with us today.
To amplify on that, fellow worker, the current president of the Amazon Labor Union, I believe his name is Chris Smalls.
Mm-hmm.
He helped found that union, and he got fired legally. Well, okay. He got fired for labor organizing, essentially. And he kept up with the union. He came back to the workplace. He kept organizing, agitating, educating, and emancipating all his fellow workers. And eventually they won. They won. And you might say that that's an extraordinary effort, and I agree with that assessment. I might have just walked away if it happened to me and I had a family to support. But this guy stuck with it, came back, kept interest in the union going. And another point to this is that he, not only did he become president of the new union, right, but he also agitated and educated enough so that it spread. They didn't win all their organizing efforts. Another warehouse in Staten Island, in New York City, they failed. They didn't have enough support. And on that point, it's usually a traditional thing that an AFL-CIO affiliated union, unless they are guaranteed that you got 70% of card check, right? These fellow workers realized that the turnover was so high in the warehouse because the working conditions were so brutal that they would never get to 70% because of turnover. Yet the message of the union hung on, and they finally deemed it time to go out, and they only had like 30% support, and they won. So the message there is you don't have to follow any kind of dictates from labor history. You got to judge the situation on your own. Judge how much support there is. How many people are so fed up that they'll go out on strike at the risk of losing their job. And they decided that 30% was enough. They won. So each situation is kind of unique, and you got to assess it as a worker.
Right. It's not always about the card check.
Right.
Or how much official support there is in the workplace in this instance. It's about how much solidarity you have with your coworkers. You can't always 100% determine whether or not a certain portion of coworkers are going to vote in favor of the union. But in Chris Smalls and the Amazon Labor Union's example, they only had a minority union.
Yes.
It's called minority unionism in the workplace.
That's right.
And they still managed to win a union election. So that, I think, is a very fantastic example of not everything has to go by the book, like you said.
That's right.
And you can still find a critical amount of solidarity and support from your coworkers in order to have a worker-led, worker-run union in the workplace. That pretty much covers everything with organizing, filing with the NLRB, how NLRB elections are carried out, what the consequences of an NLRB election are. Fellow worker Lynn, you had something to add?
I was wondering, for people who might not know, is the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, is that a city or a county office? Is it state? Is it federal? Mm-hmm. How does one get a hold of them?
If I might address the question from the fellow worker.
Go ahead.
The National Labor Relations Board was a direct result of the National Labor Relations Act, also called the Wagner Act in 1935. And that's why it's important sometimes and who wins elections. This was bitterly fought against, and it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who managed to get this through, realizing that if he didn't do something for labor, there could really be a Bolshevik-style revolution. And they wanted to avoid that. FDR did it, according to himself, to save capitalism. And it worked, you know. But the NLRB is a federal board. It's the Department of Labor. And if you go on their website, or if you just send a telegram or some smoke signals to the national office of that board in Washington, D.C., and I'm pretty sure they have satellite offices.
Mm-hmm. They do have satellite offices. Usually local offices. I believe on a state or local level, they do have some offices. Yeah,
sure.
Usually on a state level,
they have to. They have an oversight function too. The NLRB, right? So it's kind of like the constable down at the police station, Barney Fife. You know, he's got his feet up on the desk. Then the phone rings. So what? You got a problem at your... Well, let's go check it out. And a good National Labor Relations Board inspector, whatever they call them, or officer of some kind, will come down and make an assessment. And if they think that you have a good case, which in many of these, like the meatpacking plants that were rife with COVID, you know, things, people who didn't speak English as their primary language, they had to have resources, and they managed to get them. They managed to get bilingual, you know, or sympathetic organizers with them so that they can address their complaints to the NLRB. So hopefully that clears that up.
It helps, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. The NLRB can make determinations in the case of illegal firings.
Right.
Or in the case of election interference, which has happened a few times.
Yes.
Actually, really recently with some bigger organizing campaigns, as to whether or not the employer has illegally interfered in elections. They are basically the main outfit for determining whether or not a union can be legally ratified in the workplace.
Yep.
Not always. Sometimes unions do win voluntary recognition from their employers when they have a large enough critical mass. Usually, from what I've seen, and this might not be 100% true, sometimes in smaller shops it's much easier to do that because there's a smaller group of coworkers that might be able to get, you know, 80 to even 90% or even 100% support for the union to all come together, march on the boss, or at least, you know, sign a letter officially demanding that we want our union to be recognized in the workplace.
Right.
The NLRB is not the 100% method on how to get a union in the workplace.
That's correct.
It is the predominant way in which most trade unions do organizing is through these union elections. And now that the NLRB does have local offices as well as national offices to make sure that these elections are played out free and fair. When it comes to unionizing, this is kind of the last letter of this whole AEIOU acronym. This is the...
Until next month, you're going to start over again.
I know. I'll have to pick another labor... I have to pick another labor education topic. I'm sure we'll come up with something interesting. But this is kind of the end of this acronym that we have that we use to kind of help guide workers with organizing their workplaces. So by the time you've reached this point, you have a critical 70 to 80% support in the workplace, as I mentioned previously. You can file with an election with the NLRB. The NLRB will set up that election. There can be crackdowns by your boss during this time. This is usually when most crackdowns by employers take place, legally or illegally, against their workers to try and prevent this from happening. Because your employer's main concern is profit, not the well-being of its employers.
Employees.
Employees, yeah. Thank you. This is the end of this acronym. Please join us next month for when we have another fascinating topic of labor education that we're going to be bringing to you. Thank you so much for following along with us, and we certainly hope that you tune in next month. Moving on to our next topic of discussion today here on the WOB Radio Hour, we have fellow worker Gordon providing us with some brief notes from that wonderful place that we know as the Kitsap Peninsula. There's a nascent IWW organizing there, hopefully becoming a branch at some point in the future, and as well as other local events that have taken place in solidarity with the working class in the Kitsap Peninsula region. Take it away, fellow worker Gordon.
Hey, greetings, listeners and fellow workers. I'm here to report on that marvelous kingdom on the other side of the Narrows Bridge, Kitsap County, Bremerton, Polesbo, and environs. We're coming up on the holiday season, so things have kind of slowed down a little bit. You already know about our exploits from the past, our successful benefit show for Food Not Bombs, and our info picket against the Starvation Army. They were having their little confab, and we successfully did a very, very provocative info picket. What I have to report is that there's going to be another benefit concert that's going to have a lot of people as recipients. The IWW showed up in strength at the first benefit concert, bringing tons of food. Shout out to fellow worker Mac for that. We brought warm coats. We brought, you know, underclothing for adults and various health and hygiene items. And so it was a great success. We're still working on that. As a matter of fact, Today, we're having our first informational picket, or what our Bellingham fellow workers call, or Whatcom Skagit fellow workers call, a drive-by soapbox. And this is just showing the colors. We have kind of generic signs like, you know, join the union, things like that. We're not issue specific on a soapbox. And the term soapbox comes, of course, from the IWW's history during the free speech fights that happened in the early part of the 20th century and are still going on. So just giving a shout out to my IWW fellow workers and their allies. And we're up to 6 red cards now. So we got to kidnap 4 more people so that we can form our branch. But we're coming over here. We're coming back for soup. So we're not going to be gone permanently. And so that's pretty much my report, is that we're keeping on. We're doing organizing, and we have lots of allies. And what we're doing is that we decided that we were going to support our fellow workers at the most basic level. This happens to be our unhoused fellow workers, which the IWW has always viewed as they're just unemployed fellow workers. They're not, you know, drunks or drug abusers. There are some problems, but we can address that stuff when we build the new society within the shell of the old. So I'm just reporting that there's ongoing organizing in Kitsap County. Get in touch with the IWW, Bremerton Kitsap IWW. We're cobbling up a website. We're cobbling up our own agitprop. We've got signs, we've got buttons, we've got pamphlets. Thank you to the Tacoma branch for a generous donation of IWW literature.
Of course.
And we're keeping on. And we're going to grow the union. We're spreading west. And that means Holguin, Montesano, Ocean Shores, you know, the territory west of Bremerton, because they're desperately in need of unionization. And you have a shout out to give too, don't you, fellow worker Noah?
Yes, I do. As many of you have probably heard in some of the national headlines, there have been some very violent reactions towards LGBT spaces. Family-friendly drag shows are especially a popular target by far-right members of local communities and conservative organizations. There was recently a family-friendly drag show in Poulsbo, I believe this past week, where a lot of the community actually came out in support of it. They really enjoyed the show. The kids got to interact with the drag performers. You know, everybody had a great time. I've recently been to a night market here in Tacoma where they also had a family-friendly drag show back around Halloween a couple months ago. So there is a lot of community support for these LGBT spaces and performers at these family-friendly events. And I think it's really fantastic that a small town in what a lot of people would consider a pretty conservative area of the state, you know, I mean, not entirely, the peninsula is not all red, so to speak, or at least not the red the way that we would like it. You know, it is still a pretty conservative part of the state out there in the peninsula, but there was a lot of community support for this drag show that happened. And I think it really goes to show that these areas of the country that we like to see as very conservative or very religious or very reactionary oftentimes have many members of the community who are either curious about, you know, LGBT spaces and events or just people in general, or who offer a lot of support to those people and spaces. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to that because it is a very, very beautiful example that a local community in a more rural area does not necessarily need to be reactionary or right-wing to the point of threats, violence, and intimidation.
Don't write us off, fellow worker. Don't Absolutely. Write us off.
We, you know, LGBT people are everywhere, just like unionists and wobblies are everywhere. And so it's really great to see that kind of community support and that kind of defense against right-wing reactionaries in this part of the state. So good job to you, fellow worker Gordon, and all of your fellow workers out there in the IWW. We hope to hear a lot more about what's going on with the organizing there, and we will certainly be here to support your branch once you've laid the flag in the ground.
Oh, we'll be planting a flag directly in the
starvation. The heart of capital.
Yeah, there
the
you
heart
go.
Of capital. Moving forward in our radio show, we'd like to also talk a little bit on that note about other upcoming events that are taking place where you too can help support the working class. previous events that have taken place, there was a fantastic presentation by the Tacoma Labor School through this Pierce County Central Labor Council of the AFL-CIO. They had an event back on December 9th called Tacoma's Union Town, Anti-Racist Organizing in Grit City, which talked a lot about intersectionality and inclusion of minority communities in workplace organizing and working class organizing.
That's right.
To better civil rights in the workplace, protections against marginalized communities in the workplace, and how those things can really come together. The IWW, of course, has been a longtime supporter of that. We would love for you to follow the Tacoma Labor School on Facebook and look to them for any upcoming events. They've had a couple fantastic lectures about local and national labor organizing, intersectional organizing, civil rights work, and stuff like that. And they're a fantastic outfit to reach out to if you want to get better educated on labor history and ongoing labor struggles. As for other upcoming events, yes, fellow worker Gordon?
I'd just like to make note of the fact that there are local groups that you can either join or assist. And one of them is the Lived Experience Coalition. They're doing fantastic work. When we support them, we're concentrated on the unhoused population in Bremerton Kitsap. And what we've been doing is direct action mutual aid. You know, I've mentioned the meals that we serve, and I mentioned the benefit we had and collected warm clothing. But also there's ongoing sweeps that are occurring. And if you know what I'm talking about, they just come in with police and dump trucks and whatever to intimidate the unhoused people, the most vulnerable people on the face of the earth, right? They come in, they destroy their tents. They say that they're littering. They say that they're illegally camping, whatever. Anyway, there's a couple of outfits that are doing direct action to help the unhoused. The IWW at Bremerton Kitsap is very, very proud to be working with them. They're collecting backpacks with essential items in them that we can give out to the people along with our meals. And so if you want to get involved, you don't live in Tacoma maybe, you don't live in Bremerton Kitsap, there are local outfits that you can come and check out and see if they need help. And I encourage that, and so does everybody around this table.
This is out of the Tacoma DSA. There's a couple events that they are putting forward regarding organizing in our local community. RMARC Uniform Services informational pickets are currently taking place. That's through the they are organized through the UFCW 3000.
What's that outfit again, fellow worker?
The UFCW 3000.
Okay.
Is the local. The RMARC Uniform Services are having an informational picket here in Tacoma. That is going to be taking place on Wednesday, December 21st, the winter solstice. That's going to be at 6445 South Adams Street, Tacoma, Washington, 98409. And that's going to take place from 11:30 a.m. to 12 p.m. So it's a half-hour informational picket talking about how RMARC workers have been at the bargaining table since September, fighting for safer working conditions and competitive wages to improve retention and recruitment. There's also another upcoming event in January that the DSA is asking people in the community to support. That's going to be a picket at Tacoma General Hospital. That's going to be taking place Wednesday, January 4th in 2023 that starts at 6 a.m. They are basically talking about replacing workplace conditions, better pay, things that are going on with healthcare workers and the things that they're organizing around. So we'd love for you to show up on January 4th at Tacoma General Hospital at 6 a.m. to help support those workers with their struggles. That's about it for upcoming announcements and local events that are taking place here in the near future. We hope that you show up to those events and informational pickets to help support our fellow workers here in the local community. As always, you know, working class solidarity wins. And when we show up to picket lines and informational pickets like this, we can walk away better armed and better educated as to how best support our union workers out there. And now coming to the end of our WOB Radio Hour episode today, we'd just like to give one more shout out to fellow worker Marilyn, who's been a longtime producer member of the WOB Radio Hour and a longtime member of the Industrial Workers of the World. She won the Greater Tacoma Peace Prize back on the 15th of September, and she has recently visited Oslo, Norway to receive her official recognition and congratulations for that. She is currently away on vacation in Iceland at the moment, having some fun times in the countryside, and so we just want to celebrate her for her Peace Prize win. She has done so much in terms of working for the justice for working class people, for marginalized communities, and of course, like the award suggests, for advocating peace and nonviolence in our community and at large. So we just want to give a big shout out to Fellow Worker Marilyn for all the work that she's done. She's talked a lot about it previously on the WAP Radio Hour, and she is just a shining example of one person in the community who has really banded together with so many other organizations to better the conditions of working class people, of marginalized communities, of the poor, and of course, in support of peace.
Safe travels, Fellow Worker Marilyn.
Absolutely. Make it back safe. We hope that you catch your flight. She's currently stuck in Iceland. Because
snowed in? In Iceland?
Snowed in Iceland.
Who would have thunk that?
I think the name probably gave it away.
We miss you, Marilyn.
Absolutely. As for our radio show, as always, you can tune in to KTAH 101.9 Radio Tacoma. That's a low-power FM station based out of central Tacoma. This broadcast takes place at 3 p.m. and 11 p.m. on Wednesdays, and we are also broadcasting through KTQA 95.3, or you can find our radio show online at radiotacoma.org. So we want to thank you so much for tuning in today to the WAB Radio Hour. As always, it's a pleasure to inform the public as to ongoing labor struggles, organizing campaigns, and talking more about not just the history of labor organizing, but how we can advance unionism. So thank you so much for tuning in. This has been a production of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, and we hope that you'll join us again soon. Solidarity.
Solidarity forever, fellow workers.